welcome to Creative Therapy Umbrella, the podcast, the place where we talk about everything creative arts therapy and using creative modalities in therapy. Stay tuned at the end for a new segment of the podcast where we share a listener story. This one is super sweet. If you're interested in getting bonus material from the podcast and a free monthly intervention, you can go over to creativetherapyumbrella.com/newsletter and sign up there to get everything sent directly to your inbox. On today's episode, we have Danielle Mastropiero, and she is an art therapist. We cover so many topics that I had a hard time titling this episode. She dives into wellness, rural mental health, residential treatment, advocacy, working with teens, and she talks about this really cool intervention that she's doing with a DBT therapist. It was such a fun episode, and she has a great energy. So take a listen and enjoy. All right, Danielle, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I'm super excited. Danielle and I were just talking about, we realized we went to the same school and how small of a world it is.
It truly, truly is.
Yes. Yeah. So I have a great would you rather to start off today. Are you ready to hear it?
I am ready.
Awesome. Okay. So this one was sent in, I think I had posted this on, there's a Facebook group for play therapists, and this one came from a play therapist named Emma, and she asked, would you rather have a prolonged coughing fit, or would you rather have to pee really bad the entire session?
Which is really funny, because both have happened to me.
Right? That's exactly what I thought when I read this one. I was like, I have been in both of those circumstances.
Oh, it's so true. I would rather, I think I would have rather pee the whole time.
Uh-huh.
I think I'm naturally fidgety as it is, and that's just part of our sessions, and sometimes I fidget along with them. So I don't think it would interrupt it as much as the coughing fit.
It's more internalized when just having to pee is your own thing.
Yeah. And you can kind of like work your way through it in your mind while trying to pay attention. But yeah,
yes. I think
I would rather have to pee really badly the whole
time. I love that answer. I think I totally agree with you. In a different way, for me, I was thinking, because a million times I've had both of these things happen, but being a music therapist and coughing, I've had the times where it's like you get something coughed, like get something stuck in your throat, and then you like cough it out, but it's like you still have to like have a burst of a cough every like 10 seconds. And then I'm just like, I can't like get back to like baseline after that. So I feel like I would rather also just have to pee the entire time. I've done that so many times. It's like,
yeah,
almost the huge. So
pretty much.
Yes. I love it. Yeah. There's too many times where, I think it's just like in sessions, I don't know, you're back to back and it's like, oh, finally after 4 hours, I can run to the bathroom.
Yeah. I'd be like, all right, I could do this really quickly if I shuffle some things and go right now.
Yep. I have 2 minutes. Can I do this? Oh, it's awesome. So can you tell us a little bit about what you do now, where you, what you're currently doing as a therapist?
What I'm currently doing as a therapist. So currently I'm working in a rural area and we are an outpatient clinic. We have 3 med providers. We're actually getting another one by hopefully the end of the year. They're waiting for credentialing. And we just had our clinic retreat. And when we were sitting there, and I actually counted everyone because everyone came, and we had 28 people total. So minus the 3 med providers, that's 25 therapists. Mm-hmm. And we have another one starting within the next month, and then one coming back from maternity leave. So
wow, we've
grown.
Yeah, that's amazing. And for a rural area, that's fantastic.
Yeah. And it just keeps growing, and the demand keeps growing because it's a rural area, and getting services is so difficult, and maintaining services that are of a higher quality is also really difficult.
Yeah. And I would imagine like employee retention is pretty difficult too with rural area. I'm from a rural area also. Yeah. Have worked in many rural areas, and it's like, it's a, its own separate beast when you compare it to like, you know, suburban areas, or it's very, very different.
Yeah, it is extremely different. And they're, I don't think when we think rural America, we're thinking that they're underserved, but they really are underserved because of the lack of services, the lack of money, the poverty level is extreme, and which then brings in, of course, the drug abuse and alcohol abuse and the perpetuation of like family systems and always having that kind of crisis oriented lifestyle. And it just, it's hard, but
yeah, it's been hard. That's awesome. Good. It is like you were saying with like, there's the poverty piece and the cycles and stuff. And I think too, like the access, like you're driving, you know, mm-hmm. when you're in a rural area, it's like everything is 30 minutes away. You know, yeah. That's not like you can just like walk. There's not bus. You don't take buses. You don't have taxis. Uber does not exist.
It does not exist.
I would imagine if it did too, it'd be like, oh, you want to go 30 minutes? It's an $85 car ride.
I think I checked once just to like, know, because we wanted to go out to eat or whatever. I mean, a little farther to the, like the closest more populated area. And I look, and no matter how far you went, it was $40. Just no matter if you were going like a mile or all the way. And I was like, we'll just drive.
Yeah.
It's possible and it'll be fine. But no, it's true. And we, I mean, they do have like med transportation, but not everyone qualifies for med transportation. And then we have families that drive over an hour to come see us, which is because they need the quality of service. But then how sustainable is that? Like, how often can they really come to stay engaged, to really get the help that they need? And it's complicated.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh my gosh. Yeah. And that's like, I feel like that's a norm, is like to find, when you're finding quality services, it's like it, when you're in a rural area, an hour is probably the good end, which is really sad of like, you know, depending how rural it is, you could have to drive an hour and a half to a good hospital or, you know, but that's such a huge barrier for care in rural areas.
It really is.
Yeah. So how does that affect your patients and like some of those relationships and your work?
It gets really tricky because there's a couple that have stopped coming. Like they just cannot get there, and which is unfortunate because you know they need the help, but if they're not coming, and especially if they're getting meds from us and they're not coming to even those appointments, then we're responsible for their med management. And so at some point we have to do the ethical thing and like transfer it to their like primary care position, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're getting the all the services that they need. And some of it is just the stigma in the rural area, because a lot of people still struggle with accepting the mental health to normalize it, really. So that plays a part into it. And my clients, I have one that comes for an hour and a half, and I see them maybe once a month. And I'm like, you have so much anxiety that we could work on and trauma that we could process, yet we can't do that if you're not seen more often, but you can't afford to get here because mom has to work, because she has to be able to, you know, provide basic needs. It's hard. We have to keep remembering that we when people do show up, we give them the best that we can give them. Mm-hmm. It's better than not having anything at all.
Yeah. And I would imagine it's like that when someone is there, it's like, okay, they might, if you're seeing them once a month, it's like, what happens if something comes up next month? I might not be able to see them next month. So I have to like really soak up these moments and bring everything to the table.
Exactly.
Yeah. I love how you mentioned the stigma of mental health in rural areas, because I think it's really different than it is in urban areas and suburban areas. I think it's still like, it's the stigma of mental health is this crazy beast anyway, but in rural areas, it seems to be different, the idea of mental health.
It is. It's stuck in time. They're slightly behind in catching up to the importance of it and accepting it and being open to it. And I'm not saying that's everyone. There's lots of people in the community that are really supportive, and we put on events in between the different mental health places, and we have different committees that put on, like, they just did the Suicide Remembrance Awareness Day candle vigil, I think, a couple weeks ago, in conjunction with the overdose memorial too, I think. Sorry. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so we do things like that to keep promoting it, keep talking about it, because the more we talk about it, the more people will start to realize that this is something that they can be helped with. And it's really about the education of it and having those conversations. And our clinic has now pushed into, I think, 5 of the high schools, so that those kids can, they have to be connected with us. They have to do the intake process with us. But once they're connected, we can go into the school, see them at school. They're not missing as much school, or they're already at school, so parents don't have to worry about transportation, or that they're missing their own work or things like that. So finding ways to connect with them that's going to make it easier and kind of break down those barriers.
Yeah, that is so awesome that you guys do that much, like, awareness, education, and are putting that out there, especially mm-hmm. in schools. That's such a great way to start, you know, I think, you know, trying to talk to adults about mental health and trying to talk to kids. Kids are just a little bit more malleable in that, being a little more accepting of some of those new things. And it's so awesome that that's happening, that you guys provide that. It's such a great mm-hmm. resource.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think with like rural areas, there is this, at least from where I grew up, it was incredibly rural, way up in the Adirondacks, like middle of nowhere. And there, and I think it's something like, there's a lot of, like, a lot of people are doing lots of physical work. There's lots of farming, there's lots of, mill work, and, you know, those kind of jobs and stuff like that. And there's kind of like this, like, well, you just have to push through it because the work still has to get done. You know, like, we have to still go, you know, if you're farming, like, the cows still have to get milked and whatever. Yeah. I'm not a farmer.
But it's true. It's true. Yeah. Those things still have to go. They work 24/7. My husband comes off a dairy farm. They work 24/7. It does not shut down. They need to be cared for. They need to be fed, whether the milk prices are up or the milk prices are down, whether it doesn't matter. Like, it still needs to happen. Mm-hmm. And so that adds a whole nother layer, because so many families are connected with farming and these more hands-on professions and the generations of it. And it just, it impacts it all.
Yeah. Yeah, it really does. It's a hard, it feels like a deep groove that is hard to help people kind of move out of and see some other, except be more accepting, or, you know, willing to try stuff. And, mm-hmm. But it's awesome that where you work, you guys are doing all of that education, which is, it's mm-hmm. fantastic. I hope it continues to get better, for sure.
Yeah.
So what's the age range of clients that you work with? The diagnosis, what's, is kind of all over, or?
So it's an outpatient community clinic. So yeah. I can have someone, I think the youngest I had was 4. And then it goes up from there. I think the other art therapist that works there, she saw a 93-year-old man the other day, because he got discharged from the hospital, and they just wanted, they had some concerns and wanted to, like, just touch base. But, like, mm-hmm. it could go any, as long as you can get to us. That's the age range. Cool. I personally, I work with a lot of teens and kids and young adults. That's like my chunk.
Yeah,
it's kind of evenly sporadic through there. I never thought that I wanted to work with that I honestly, I honestly thought that I was only going to work with kids and families, like kids like under 12. And like, that's what I thought my chunk was going to be. And then I spent a year doing residential and they were all teenagers. And I was like, game over. I really like teens. Like, they're just like this different species. And so like, I really appreciate them. So that's where like my wiggle room is. I do have some, so not only do I get to do, be a primary therapist and have my own clients, I also get to do, when my scheduling allows, adjunctive art therapy. So that means that I get to work with other people's clients. So they have their primary therapist and then they get to see me for more hands-on creative, like, experiences. And so, I actually had, several that are on the older end. They had worked with our other art therapist before us, who actually retired. So they were transfers, but they're still great. They engage. They're awesome. And I enjoy working with them too. So it's just being open to it.
Yeah, that I would imagine requires a lot of flexibility on your part.
Yes. You just gotta go with the flow, whatever happens that day.
Yeah.
You never know. There could be someone that has been just cruising along and everything's been great and they come in and just drop a bomb on you. You never know.
Oh, totally. Oh my gosh. Yeah. We always have to be ready at the ready. Oh, yeah. I'm curious what made you, when you worked in residential, not really kind of thinking it was your thing and then you did it and then you were like, I love this. was there like a moment or like, is there a particular client that kind of really like, you know, just resonated with you or something like that, that kind of that, you know, where did that shift happen, I guess?
Oh, okay. So I absolutely love residential. I absolutely love it. But there was many factors that went into it because most people, they assume that I left residential because of the population of the teens, of the hard diagnoses. Like that's why they think that, like that's what they assume. And they always say it. And I'm like, no, I absolutely love residential. You have, yeah, when you hear it's only a caseload of like 8 to 10 like clients, like you're like, oh, that must be easy. But like, no, like these are kids, these are teenagers that can't be safe in the community and they need to be hospitalized in some kind of facility. And you get to see them every single day and you get to know them and their personalities and you get to actually start teasing out their personalities from the symptoms. And it's just like, oh my gosh, you are an amazing human being and I need to help you start to see that as much as possible so that you can start to, you know, work on these things. And I think I also ended up with all teenage girls, just like how it panned out. Mm-hmm. I had all teenage girls all living together. And so like they all had the same therapist and they all knew they had the same therapist. And so, I always thought that they were going to be like ridiculous about it, but then it turned out that they were actually, they just got it. Like, okay, we all live together. We all have the same therapist. She's not going to, she only focuses on me when we're together and that's great. And just the moments where it clicked, there was one girl, she was 16, I think. And she was just, and I just have to say Eeyore, like she was Eeyore and she had, and she had come in and she was like, okay, I'm 5 feet tall. So she was probably average height, like 5'7", but 5'6", 5'7". But like, to me, she was much taller than me. And she just came in and she was very angry and she would talk the talk and just be like, I'm going to F you up and blah, blah, like not directly to me, but like, if they don't shut up, I'm just going to go after them. You can't stop me, blah, 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 like just amping it up. And the more I got to know her, the more like she had the best sense of humor and she was super caring. And like, I literally would just look at her and be like, no, you're not, because you're a caring person. And she was there. She was supposed to be discharged around the time that I left. So she was there for like 6 months. So she was one of my longer, I was there for 9 months. So like she was there for 6 or 7 months and we were like 3 months in and she was still saying these things. It was like, have you put your hands on anyone yet? And she goes, no. And I'm like, okay, that's not you. That's just the talk that you're giving me. So let's start working on. And like, there was days that she'd be laying on the floor. She goes, I'm just tired. I'm just lazy. I'm like, no, you're depressed. Like this. And like, I would, you know, be clinical and like pull out all the symptoms and be like, this, that equals depression. And that is why you are curled up on the floor right now. There's nothing medically wrong with you. She would say she was sick. And so like one day we're sitting there and we had named the depression something else. Like we were doing CBT worksheets, and instead of saying depression, because she didn't want to talk about depression, we like named it something else. And I don't remember what she picked. And so I was reading this worksheet and replacing all the depression, like word depression, with this other word. And she one day looks at me and she goes, you know, we could just call it what it is. It's depression. And so like, it was like, oh, hallelujah. But like seeing that transformation and getting to actually walk through every stage of that journey with her was like, this is amazing. This is awesome. I love it.
Yes. Like breaking down those walls and like slowly and like, you know, especially too, I don't have a ton of experience with teens, but like teens will throw flack at you big time. Yes. Like you have to be, I'm like 4'10 and a half, 10 and three quarters.
Short people unite.
Yeah, for real. So like, I do not have that in like that intimidation factor at all of like, and so I think sometimes when you're little, like there can kind of be this like, oh, I have like 9-year-olds who are taller than me. Like it's like, oh,
it's insane. It's insane.
You really have to be ready to just kind of be like, to like have that like, oh wait, no, I think you're just, you haven't done this yet. Like you're, you know, this is, you're putting up a wall or, yeah. You know, that's so cool to see that she, you know, broke that stuff down and you were able to just kind of like find that door to like, yeah. Open it all up, and then that she was accepting of it, like, all right, okay, fine, yes, I'm depressed.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
Yeah, and it just working residential gives you that time that you like, they're there, they're not going anywhere. Like,
yes, yeah,
it just they're there. Like, you can, okay, you got home from school, you're having a crap day, okay. I'm going to walk away and I'll come back in like a couple minutes and I'll talk to you then. And like, you don't have to have this pressure. Like, I only get this amount of time with them and that's it. Like I then they go home, but no, they're there. They're there. And you could come back and you could be like, hey, you ready now? Can we talk now? Like,
mm-hmm. And when you were talking about like the timeline of like that, you know, that whole transformation happened with her in such a short amount of time, you mm-hmm. know, and that speaks on, you know, with residential, it's like you have that time is on your side there where it's like, okay, let's dig into this stuff while we can, versus somewhere like, you know, where you're saying now, or it's similar to my job too, where it's like, I can see you every other week for 45 minutes, or, you know, where you don't have that, it's you're battling time constantly, mm-hmm. like a whole separate beast for sure.
And you never quite know if someone's coming back.
I know. Oh, that is the truth. It is always the truth.
Outpatient, you never, ever know. You could have the most amazing, like, feeling and be like, oh yeah, we really connected. Like, this is awesome. And then they just never come back.
Yes. Worst.
Yeah. And you're like, okay,
like going through my Rolodex of those kiddos that I've had and I'm like, no.
Yeah.
Where are you? Come back in the universe, just come back. It's such a bummer. That is a beautiful story though. I love that her seeing her hearing about her change, and especially in such a short amount of time. It's really cool. I've never worked in residential, so I have no experience like thinking about having that much time. It's always, I feel like I'm always on the opposite end of like, I have no time. We only have, you know, this much time to get into stuff. And that is such an awesome, awesome thing to have with residential.
Yeah. It was a different experience.
Yeah. Yeah. Very. Now you're in this place where it's completely opposite with time.
Yeah. 100%.
Yeah. I love that. Do you have any, and maybe this is with residential, if it's still, you know, coming to your mind there, but like, what are the challenges? And, you know, maybe you can speak on both the challenges of residential. We spoke on a little bit of challenges, you know, especially with the rural area and outpatient too, but, what are the challenges like for some of those
challenges? So challenges with residential is you feel like you have all the time and none of the time at the same time, because there are administering bodies that are like, okay, residential, these kids need to be out in 4 to 6 months. Okay, that's great. But it takes them about 3 months to figure out that they're not leaving. And that sounds not okay, but there are, I had a girl that came in and she's from day one, she goes, I just want to leave. I want to go home. She did not want anything to do with it. And it took her 4 months to be like, okay, my gateway out of here is to actually do some work. Like, it, what are you supposed to do? And then they come back and they're like, well, why are these kids not leaving? And I'm like, you can't force them. It's just like an adult. You cannot force anyone to get the help unless they want the help. And they want, and then if they're being honest with themselves, like, nothing we can do can change that. We could just be there, be supportive, keep offering our service to them and our help to them, but we cannot make it click for them, and they have to want to have that click. So that was a challenge. And I mean, a lot of the challenge had to do with like timelines and administrative stuff and like expectations from like stuff that I couldn't control. But challenges just directly with the residential kids, I think also, my residential, where I was working residentially, was like a city. Like, it wasn't rural, even though some of these kids came from rural. Like, they came from literally the middle of nowhere, no cell phone service, like rural. Then you had kids that came from the city. Then you had kids that were in foster care placements that didn't really necessarily have a family to even go home to. And so like those were kind of challenges, because there were some kids that just like got stuck there because they were having such a difficult time finding them a next place to exist. And like that adds on a whole other level of like, there was a young girl there that her parents had given up their rights, and she had been there, I think, 2 years. Because she just didn't have anywhere to go, anyone stable either, because her parents gave up rights. But then I think they were immigrants, and so she immigrated here, has lived here all her life, but wasn't born here. And so then like there's a language barrier, and like just finding someone who also accepted her mental health, because culturally, and just so like all these other layers of just things we can't control.
Yeah, those, like, it's like the outer onion, mm-hmm. those peels of that. That's so much. And I think all of that stuff is like, it's interesting to think about, you know, all of these kids coming to this one place, mm-hmm. and them all having their own intricate things that are like, you know, those barriers, you know, if it's a rural area and they're going out of residential, well, where do they go after that? Like, if they don't have access to stuff, and if it's, you know, foster care, you know, that just like so much of the system there is, there's just so, and it's also different. That's got to be so hard to navigate.
Yes. And so luckily, so how residential in theory should work is like, there's the therapist, but then there's also their, I think they were called transition coordinators, but basically professionals that link them with services and kind of prepare for that after. So when everyone's doing their job properly, then that should be the transition of like therapist does therapy. And then there's like caseworker or transition coordinator or whoever who starts to link them to services in the communities and like mm-hmm. do that, that linkage work. But
yeah, that feels like that's so cool. I've never even heard of that job before, but that's fantastic, because that's like a full-time job that you're
100%.
Yeah, to know all of the, you know, and I would imagine there's a lot of like social work that comes into that, and you have to know where the resources are, who to get in touch with, how to help and make that, because that's a big transition. That is a huge transition.
Yeah, it's huge. And to also go from being kind of contained mm-hmm. and like overseen for month days and months on end, and then to transition into this more freedom.
Yeah.
It's like not everyone can handle it.
Yes. Yeah. It reminds me of, and in a very different way, but of like the transition from being in the service to then being like a civilian again. Yeah. Is it's just like you're so used to this structure, this way of life, and then all of a sudden it's totally different, like overnight, you know? Yep. And it's a, yeah, there's got to be a lot that comes up with that for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Cool. Oh my gosh. I had no idea about all this residential stuff. I love it. So interesting. So for being an art therapist, what has, and for outpatient, residential, how, whatever you want to speak on, how has creativity helped your clients? Like, what have you seen the process of creativity do for your specific clients? What has that been like?
So unfortunately, I didn't get to do a lot of art therapy in residential because I was hired as a therapist. Because art therapy, you take all the same classes as like the social workers and the other mental health counselors. Like you do all the other work. You just also learn how to implement art with it all and what materials to use and what materials not to use with certain people and like how to like show, like recognize patterns to that have been scientifically linked to like certain diagnoses and like that kind of stuff. So so I was hired as a therapist and didn't get the opportunity to start incorporating as much art therapy there. Outpatient, it ranges. It ranges from like using art as therapy, and art therapy are two different things. Art as therapy is allowing someone maybe to utilize creativity in session while talking to me, because that helps them to not focus on the fact that they're talking to me, where art therapy is a little more directive and like where we have a little bit more intent on what we're trying to like process and work through. Sometimes it's art as therapy. Art as therapy, you're not really processing anything. You're not really getting nitty gritty. It's using creativity to kind of like maybe just open up a little bit and be more comfortable. And like, if, especially if you're the people that fidget or have hard time like talking with people, like distract them. Like you distract them and they use it as a calming way. I've been doing a lot of like Zentangle kind of stuff, which is just small little patterns repeated over and over. And I've seen a change in some of my clients that would literally sit there and stare at me. And some of them are so anxious, they can't get words out. And some of them, I couldn't tell you because they don't talk to me. But once we started doing like the Zentangle, they might like bring a little bit up, and it might just be like something that bummed them out like during the day. But like, that's more than just staring at me for 45 minutes. Like that's not productive for either of us. Even though I've gotten very good at just sitting with it and just practicing just sitting with it, but
with the uncomfortableness.
Yes. It's okay.
It's hard.
Silence is okay. Yes. But at least if I could provide them with something to maybe distract them or feel more comfortable, because a lot of people are like, why the heck are you staring at me? But if we could be sitting there, and a lot of time I won't automatically engage in the art making too, unless a lot of, since I have a lot of teens and kids, they'll most likely invite me. They'll be like, you should do it too. Or why aren't you doing it too? Or like, what are you going to do? And like, so then I'll be like, okay, thank you for inviting me. And like, I'll give them that control and that validation. And so so even me not staring at them, I've had several people start to open up because I'm not staring at them anymore.
The pressure's not on.
Who really wants someone sitting there staring at you? Not really anyone.
I would not be able to talk as much if someone was just like waiting for it. I'd be like, oh, all right.
And like, I can only ask so many questions. And like, at some point you have to kind of take initiative over your sessions and like,
yeah,
feel comfortable. So that's like more like art as therapy, like using it to open up and be creative and just kind of get the juices flowing and feel relaxed and, you know, all that good stuff. And then art therapy is when you actually get to like the processing stuff and like targeting things and getting into like more of the nitty gritty. And so like, one kid popped in my head who, I think part of it had to do with like the meds he was on kind of like dulled him a little bit. So there was like, at this point, there was like a med change. And then we also did this activity or this directive that I was like, hey, can you draw a monster that's in your life? And then I give some examples, like some people have a depression monster and some people have an anxiety monster and some people like different like examples. And so like he did this awesome drawing where I have a window, bless the Lord's. Bless the universe for a window, because I did
anyone
not have a window.
Anyone who's not had a window is like, immediately, I've had so many offices not having a window. So as soon as you said
which it. I feel bad. Like, there's all, so they remodeled the building. Like, when they bought the building, it was just a remodel building. So they didn't have a choice that not everyone got windows. So, like, I got lucky. I have a window. I have plants on my windowsill, and they're succulents. And so he had used the shadow from the succulent to like trace the shadows, and they were like spiky. And so then he then took that and then created three monsters out of it. And it was interesting because like he went from like left to right, and on the left hand side it was like the angry monster, and then like, and it was in like red, and then like the middle one was like the even more angry monster, and it was like a yellow and like still had some like warm colors to it. But then the last monster was like the even more angry, like it was just like the words were intensified because he actually wrote it out, but the colors were cooler and they were blues and greens, and they were and the spikes, even though he did like trace them, he could have done it the opposite way, but he chose it this way. And like the monster itself had like smoother lines and it wasn't as spiky. And so like, even though the word said one thing, the process said another thing. Mm-hmm. And like, it was just very interesting to see and very cool to see him. Like the more he like went through the process, even though the monsters were labeled more angry monsters, he himself, you could even see him like relax more and like be more like toned down, and like, so that's where the process gets really cool.
I feel like I would be there's so many questions I would want to ask about that, of like, you know, asking about like, wow, your really angry monster looks kind of smooth.
Yeah, like, but he doesn't look so angry.
Yeah. And then it's like, did the process help with that? Or is there something, like, I think of kids too, like even some teenagers, where it's like, there's that angry red shaking, like, I am so angry. And then there's that angry where you're just like, I'm so angry, I've given up. Like, I'm just like shut defeated. Down. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Like red.
Yeah. Exactly. That is so cool. That's such an amazing process.
Yeah. No, it's awesome to see people go through that process of like how they can really change and how much you could tell based on a person's perspective and where they're at. Or I had one guy, super anxious and OCD and depressed and just like, whoa, like a just tightly like compacted. And it must have been around the same time I was on that kick of the whole monster thing. because I had him draw a monster, and it was on a sheet of paper that was like maybe 6x6. And he used colored pencils with non-art therapy people, which colored pencils are more restrictive because they can be really controlled. So someone who's anxious or depressed or like OCD, like pen, and colored pencils are more controlled. And so then they can feel like they have more control. Where on the opposite end of it is like, if I had given him watercolors, he probably would have lost it because, mm-hmm. or like not actually lost it, but like internally couldn't manage it because it's too fluid and he can't control it. And that would raise up the emotions inside of him. And he wouldn't be able to, at that time, he really would not have been able to then like self-soothe himself because it's just too much going on. Mm-hmm. So he used colored pencils, which was by choice. Like I said, markers are colored pencils. And then he had drawn this circle, and then on top of the circle were like two eyes. But in the middle of the circle, he drew a what later he told was a man, and the man was it was just like an outline of a man, but he was nude. There was no clothes on him. And he had like all these strings coming from him. Like, and he told me that he was like stuck inside the monster and that he was tethered down and he couldn't figure out how to break free from being tethered to this monster. And I'm just like, that's so much more insight than you've given me in weeks.
Like, you've never verbally given me anything.
Any of that. And like none of that. Like that was me like, what?
Uh-huh.
I ask you about anxiety and there's no words. I ask you to draw a monster and there's all of this. And I'm like, this is insightful. This is awesome.
Yes. I love that. Is like, I can't tell you with how many conversations having with people about that. And in some creative format, that's exactly what everybody says. It's like, mm-hmm. you know, I've talked to this client, we've, you know, asked these questions, you know, even an assessment, done all this stuff. And like, it's not necessarily maybe that the insight isn't there, but it's not able to like come out for some reason. It's not, you know, but that creative mode of like, oh, I'm stuck in this monster and I'm tethered and I'm so tied down and it's heavy. And like all of that stuff is so, there's something so different in expressing it in a creative modality than trying to say it, you know, in an eloquent way.
Yeah. People don't have words for that, especially if they're really struggling. Like you don't have the words for things. So
yeah. And I would imagine too, like thinking about something like that, that feels really physical. Like if you're tethered to something, like mm-hmm. If you're disconnected from your body, from like those feelings of like, how do you put that physical feeling into words that do it justice, you know? Yeah. Gosh, that's so cool. I love that. I love how much you spoke on like the difference and the benefits and that I think the importance of like, I'm going to say arts instead of art, but like arts as therapy and then like creative arts therapy, you know, creative arts as therapy and then creative arts therapy and how important both of those are in what we do. You know, I feel like it's not one or the other. I know, I remember like in school having to read all the different like theories of, you know, like all, you know, they're great, but you know, like it's this one and then there's this one and it's like, oh, well, this one's really good. Oh, well, this one's really good. But having like all of those at our disposal is so fantastic because there's so many great places for, you know, using arts as therapy and then using arts therapy like that.
Exactly. And so, and like people need to know the difference of what it is and like the intricacies and like that just opens a whole other conversation about, you know, scope of practice, but that we're not here for.
Exactly. Yes. Oh, there's so many times where I'm like, I need to do a really long episode about scope of practice, especially because, well, and this podcast being a very big umbrella of creative arts therapy, it is that difference of like, you know, and we have to do it all the time of like, you're not an art therapist because you draw in sessions, you know, like you're not a music therapist if you decide to bring a drum into your session, but you can use, you know, you're using some of the arts in therapy, which is fantastic. Yeah. Like we need more of that. I think it's great. But yeah, having the advocacy
is really hard. And like bringing that up to people sometimes get really uncomfortable when you call it out and they're like, but I'm like, I'm not saying anyone's in the wrong. I'm just letting you know that like you're treading a thin line. And I went to school and paid lots of money to learn why you should not be using clay with that person.
Yes. Yes. And like, and that's why I'm so glad that you are talking about it because this is such an important thing to touch on and that like, and we're all, you know, everybody who's in a different discipline, if you're a play therapist, music therapist, whatever, dance, there is, you know, as a creative arts therapist, we appreciate all of the arts and want to use them, but there's a line. And I think having that self-awareness of like, when do I need to talk to somebody? Like, okay, like, you know, this was helpful, but like, whoa, this just sent up a flag. Like, maybe I shouldn't use this or something. Like, I just had the other day, I had this client I was working with and we use music as like a discussion kind of tool. We do like songwriting, lyric analysis, kind of stuff like that. But sometimes she gets going on a roll and like talking about stuff and she needs to like doodle, like she needs to be busy, like that fidgetiness, like to do something. So she chose from a bunch of different things. She wanted to do these different things. So she started coloring while she was talking And we had all this relaxing music playing and stuff. And I noticed as she was coloring that she colored two different things very differently. She chose markers, you know, and she did these two different things. One was for one parent and one was for the other. And they were very different. And I was like, way out of my scope. I need to go talk to somebody about this.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was like, I have no idea what this means. This was really just kind of a, like a fidget thing, you know, of like, sure, she loves art and, you know, bringing it in. And, but the, it was, it said so much that like, I need to talk with an art therapist about it because yeah. It was like, okay, this is, that is that step beyond of like, I need to be aware of that. And especially respecting that in our own creative arts therapy. But, but then there's the people who are outside of our, which is a whole nother beast.
So many layers.
There really is. And explaining it like outside of that, it is so hard. It's so, so hard.
It is. And it's frustrating. And like, And I'm like, I'm glad these things are being offered, but sometimes it's just the treading a very, very, very thin line.
Yeah.
I wish people would just be like, oh, maybe I should just team up with an art therapist. And then I wouldn't be treading any lines, but I could still have these awesome ideas. And like,
I'm hoping that this podcast will help serve some of that of like, these people are out there. Like, go find them, go talk to them. You can always consult with people. Like, if you're consulting, you are not, if then you're taking away some of that scope of practice. You're opening a thing of like, oh, I consulted with somebody. Like,
yeah.
You know, if I mean, co-treating is my favorite thing in the world. Like, go co-treat with somebody, you know, bring somebody else in if you can. And it's just, yeah, that scope of practice is so, so hard. But so important. We need to talk about it more. We really do. Yeah, for sure. Well, speaking on scope of practice, I think this is for interventions. We do, you know, I love asking people about what their current, you know, intervention, directive, prompt, resource, strategy, whatever, something that's resonating with you lately, like in your work that's been, you know, if it's theme oriented, a lot of people have talked about Halloween or, you know, Thanksgiving and stuff, but within what is something that you would share for listeners, if you're staying in your scope of practice, but you know, yeah, something that you would share for others or, you know, other art therapists or other people, anything that you would want to share.
Okay. So many things are popping in my head. But like,
yes,
the last couple of weeks have been very crazy. So I haven't been like, I have an intern right now. And then I also transitioned to like pushing into one of the schools, and I'm also preparing to co-lead a DBT group. The other therapist is trained in DBT and I'm bringing the art component to it. So learning about DBT has been something that I've been like latching on with, and I'm really excited that like this, they started this group. It was two other therapists, like the therapist that I'm doing it with, and then another therapist that had started it for adults. And so this is actually the third round of it that they're doing. Mm-hmm. And one of the therapists steps back. So she asked me to step in and bring some more hands-on creative like experiences to it. And so actually looking at DBT and the components of it, and then connecting it with hands-on art interventions so that it could solidify some of the concepts for them. So for example, so dialectics, and if anyone doesn't know what dialectics is, it's dialectics is having that black or white mindset. It's like one extreme or the other. Like something happens at work and I need to quit my job, or like or the other side of it, I need to put more time into my job and become a better whatever you're doing. Yep. And not having that gray area in between. And I mean, lots of our clients struggle with that, with that black and white thinking. And so I brought in an activity in which we used black and white paint, and I had them have like a black circle on one side of the paper and a white circle on the other side of the paper. And we talked about like either something that we gave them some examples, and we're like, either use one of our examples, or if something pops into your mind from your own life, like you have to deal with, like, what is that black or white thought? Those two extremes, like, I have to clean the whole house today, or I'm not going to touch a single thing and it's too much and I'm not going to do it. And so, like, those are the polar opposites. And then talking about how, well, there's this whole gray area in between, and having them use black and white paint to then mix and make the gray areas in between, normally say like three gray area, like three shapes in the middle, and then have them write out like the in-between thoughts, like, oh, I can clean one room today, or I could create myself a cleaning schedule so I'm not overwhelmed, or like whatever, and like having those open conversations. So that's what I'm diving into right now in terms of like where the next couple months are going for me.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Oh my gosh, yeah. That's so cool to think of, like, your it's funny because it's so you know, black and white thinking is very concrete in that it's yes or no, it's this or that. Mm-hmm. And you're taking it and making it, you know, concrete in like literally making it, you know, mm-hmm. something like that. But then that abstract piece of having like those shades, I hate to say 50 shades of gray. That would be a terrible reference, but
well, 50 shades of gray.
You're making these shades, and like, I think that experience of like making that's got to be really interesting for people who are struggle with that black and white thinking. And then you have to go and make this gray. That's like, do I make it a dark gray? Do I make it a light gray? Are they all the same? there's so many gray questions.
I know. And it's so true, because they all come at me. They're like, and this also layers like into, I had to explain it to someone. I'm like, this is not art class. There are no grades. There are no like expectations. I'm not even worried about what the heck it looks like.
Yeah.
And so like, we didn't do my background, but like my undergrad degree was in art education. I had my licensure. It's probably expired because I didn't pursue it.
Yeah.
But the old style of art education is, here's the cookie cutter project, and now you need to make that cookie cutter project, and it needs to look like this, and you're going to be graded on how well it looks like this. Mm-hmm. And so there are, it's really cool because that's a whole other conversation, but they're kind of getting more away from that in some theories. But so many people are actually like, traumatized is a heavy word, but like that whole, like, they get really anxious about it, like, yes. Super, super anxious that they're back in art class. And that's like, a lot of people actually shy away from like art therapy in general. Mm-hmm. Because they think of it as class, and they think of it as like, I'm being judged, and that I'm not a good artist. But it's not that you're not a good artist. Everyone's an artist. I mean, hey, if you like doing your makeup, you're an artist. If
yes.
you like doing your hair, you're an artist. If you like building cars, if you like, all these things is all artistry. It's all creativity. Just our society hasn't trained our brains to think like that. So
yes, it's so, so true. And that is such a big difference of like, when people say this all the time with music, they'll be like, I can't sing. I'm like, You don't have, everybody can sing, because you're just making your words connect together and moving them around a little. Like, everybody can sing, you know, and it's like, but there is so much judgment on the performance of, or the end product. And it's like retraining people to think about like, no, this is process. Like, this is all about the process, not what it looks like at the end, or how it sounds at the end, or whatever. Yeah, yeah. It's a hard rut to get people out of.
Yeah, it really is. But yeah. I just keep reminding them, I don't care what it looks like.
Yes. Yeah. And that's so cool that you have an arts education background, because mm-hmm. you have that like comparison. You have a really cool comparison to have now, as, because those are really, I don't want to say black and white, but they're polar. Yeah.
They are. And that's why it's like, and that's why I say traditional art education is like that, because there are some theories coming out and people are actually shifting away from those cookie cutter things and giving more freedom in the creative process during art education. So like it's becoming more of that gray area slowly as people start to expand and kind of be exposed to these different ways of doing it. But it is like the traditional way of art education and art therapy are like totally different.
Yeah. I love that. That intervention sounds so cool. And I love thinking about DBT and art together. I've never even really thought about, I'm sure somebody out there does it with DBT and music, but like, it's a really cool combination to, yeah. I think for listeners to think about. And, you know, if listeners haven't had about it before, like how can you bring creativity into a lot of that stuff? And
yeah,
make it less concrete by using abstract means, I guess.
Yeah. And giving examples in that hands-on and having the challenging them and yourself to think outside of the box in terms of these skills, because you can have people. So like I said, this is going to be the third round. And a lot of people have taken it twice. Like they either did the first round and are going to do this round, or they did like two times in a row. And like, you can tell with talking to the other therapists that ran it the other times, like each time they come back, they learn something else in a new way. Like they learn and it connects in a new way. And she's like, even every time I teach it, I get a better understanding of it. And that's what I'm excited about, because I'm going to get a better understanding about it. And then not only am I going to help that group, but I'm going to take it back to my individual clients, because we don't have a teen DBT group yet. So like then taking it and being able to like creatively sneaky magically like give it to my teenagers who like don't actually want to learn anything, but we're gonna do it in this creative way so that you don't think we're actually learning anything. Like
we are master manipulators. Woo. For the good, for a good direction, but really yeah. We are
just gotta massage the situation to make it work. It's fine.
I like that way better. We just are really massaging the situation. Oh, that's fantastic. That's so cool too. And I mean, that's, I think speaks on, you know, so much of like we were saying earlier, of when you're like co-treating or you're co-leading with another therapist or somebody outside of what you do, you know, and how much that benefits so many other, it's just like perpetual domino effect of like, it's going to now, you know, you're thinking of all these new creative ideas, you're learning more. And then you're like, cool, how can I massage this into my teen clients and bring it to them? It's awesome. Yeah. I love that so much. Well, so if, do you have anything that is a, and this doesn't have to be clinical related, therapy, you know, larger picture related, your passion project, something you're really passionate about, on a different level than clinical, I guess.
Can I have two answers?
Of course you can have two answers. I would be a terrible therapist if I said,
no.
You need to have one.
No, because I kind of knew this was coming and I was like, I can't pick because
don't pick.
when I'm at the clinic and I'm talking to people, I get very, very jazzed up about trauma work. I tell people like, I literally like salivate when I'm like, oh my God, we can work with, like, we can help you. Like,
I can see you shaking as you're talking about it.
Like, it's just so fascinating what the mind can do and what the mind does to protect itself and how people can be so resilient and like survive all of these things and like be there. And I don't know. So it's fascinating to me. Yes. And so I got an opportunity to actually, I didn't get to do EMDR yet, but I got to be trained in progressive counting at the Trauma Institute in Buffalo, New York. And so then I have been applying it, and another struggle with outpatient is people committing and coming and like going through the process, because sometimes people start to like get those big emotions and like, even if they know they're cognitively ready for trauma work, sometimes the emotions are too big and they get frightened and it's just like a stop sign for them. So like,
yeah.
So sometimes they don't go through with the whole thing, but I did get the opportunity this summer. She was a transfer to me. She had been in therapy very long. Like, she's a young adult, has been in therapy, has her own stuff. And she finally said, I'm ready. I am ready to do this. I'm home for the summer. I want to commit. And so we made sure that like she checked with insurance. She could be seen an unlimited amount of time. It wasn't an issue with all that. We like did that prep work. And We started when she got back from school, and we did double sessions all through the summer. I think there was like 1 or 2 weeks that we didn't because of like vacation and stuff. But like, we went through that whole process, and it just happened that there was a treatment plan review that was due right before she left for school again. And during that review, we were just talking about like her symptoms and stuff. And she was able to, and I didn't even think to ask, like, I don't know why I didn't, but at the moment I didn't think to ask like directly related to like the trauma work, but she said like her sorry about that.
Oh no, I didn't hear anything.
Okay. My phone went off. She didn't, her nightmares had got away. She wasn't having her nightmares. She felt more comfortable being in the community because unfortunately her abuser lives in the community, but she's like, I don't feel as anxious walking into a store anymore. Like, okay, yeah, I know cognitively he's around, but like, I don't feel like I need to have someone with me in order to go into the store, like into stores or like around town anymore. And there was like something else that like she was able to do and not be like triggered. She was just like, oh, okay, that like happened to me, but that isn't me now. And like, just seeing that process, and like, I'm like, I want to do more of that because I know that this could help. And so, and I've also integrated art therapy into that too. So like, we were able to like do both and use both. And so like, ultimately, I would love to do, even if it was just adjunctively, like people had their primary and they came in and all we focused on was trauma work. And like,
yes, it's so like, oh, that's and like such a beautiful, beautiful story. And so like, there's nothing I think more like satisfying than, especially with trauma, to hear, see, feel that somebody has moved down in that like fight or flight of like, you know, where it's like, you're not at that point where it's like, everything is a threat. You've like calmed down just that. That is so, and how cool that you can bring, you can integrate, you know, the creative arts into that as needed for that client. It's so awesome.
It was, is,
oh my gosh.
It's rewarding when people are ready to face it. And I know that that's a process, and that's part of like, I've on my own and have to accept that like, not everyone is ready for that next step. Mm-hmm. And they're not ready, but I educate them from day one. Like, this is what could help. Mm-hmm. There's science behind it. Like, you need, I'm going to keep bringing it up. I'm never going to force you to do it. But I'm just going to keep on bringing it up so that you know it's there when you are ready.
Yes.
And so I have another client that actually came back, like was discharged because he had a hard time engaging, and like came back and he said that he was interested. He's like, I think I'm ready for DBT group. I think I'm ready to start heading towards trauma work. Like, and we'll see, like, it's not a guarantee, but like, that's such a huge step to even like say, I think I can do this. Like, okay, yeah. I'm on your team. Let's go.
Yeah. You know, that person has been, and I think that speaks a lot too on you as a therapist, is that person has taken those little nuggets, those little seeds, and they're in there, and it's like, okay, I'm ready to water them. Like, I know they're there. I'm aware enough. I'm thinking about it. I'm aware enough that I know it's a problem, and I'm aware that there is a way to fix it. And I feel brave enough, strong enough, whatever, to try that next step, whatever it might look like. That's so awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's my, so yeah. So that's like my clinical passion. Like, this is what I want to evolve to do. And like, as I'm learning more to like help support my clients to maybe get to that point. And like, it's all a learning process. So mm-hmm. we'll see over time where that takes me. And then my second passion project actually was born out of my own need for self-care.
Yeah, that's perfect. I love it. Yes, yes.
I talked about it a little bit on my Instagram last week because I was talking about burnout and the effects of burnout and that kind of stuff. And someone else, another art therapist actually, we got to talking, and she asked me, like, I'm in a situation that is actually quite similar to where I was. And she was telling me how she's processing a lot of like, what is burnout and how do I combat that and like all this stuff. And it got me to thinking about like my own story and And I now that I look back, I was burnt out. I was at a residential with other things going on, and I was planning a wedding, and I was out of grad school and like going full force, and like that had, so I was an athlete for like all my life, and then just stopped because I was in grad school and like wasn't structured into my life. And like, so things happen to your body when that happens. And I don't think, and I tell people, if you look at pictures, you don't honestly, you might not know, but like I felt like more fatigued, and I had a harder time with like managing anxiety. And I mean, I don't think I was clinically depressed, but I think that played a very big factor. And like, it was also like the worst winter too. So let's throw that in there.
And a New York winter for listeners who are not in New York.
Wait, hold on. A Western.
Western. So I never realized this until I'm in Colorado and the winter's here, like it snows and then it's gone. And it's like, in New York, it's like, oh, it's going to snow in October and it won't be gone until April. Mm-hmm. Not going anywhere.
Yeah, doesn't go anywhere, and traveling. And there's just like so many different like stressors. Yes. And I had stopped. So being active was like such a huge part of my life that I actually took for granted, because it was just natural from like the time I was 8 until like 20 something. So like it didn't click in my brain that was what was managing literally everything.
Yeah.
So then like we would eat out all the time, and like, so that played a factor in it, because the American diet is not a good one.
Mm-hmm. It's so terrible.
They literally have scientists who engineer the processed food to get you addicted to it. Like,
I feel that.
And I mean, I'm not saying I don't eat the good stuff. Like, I don't avoid them completely, but like it blows my mind that there are scientists sitting there like, how can I make this the most addictive thing to make this company money? Like,
yep. Mm-hmm.
Which is backwards of how can I help people to fuel their bodies and be healthy. And so then I wanted to feel better for my wedding, which is what I thought at first, but now it's, looking back, I'm like, I just needed to feel better in general. Mm-hmm. And so that I jumped full force, because that's the type of person I am. If you do something, you're going to do it all way. Yes. And got into the online wellness coaching and nutrition. And I tell people, I'm not a nutritionist. I'm not going to create a plan for you. I am not going to be your personal trainer in terms of like telling you how to work out or anything. Like, no, like I'm not going to do it. A lot of people are like, well, what should I do? Like, well, you should talk to your doctor about this, and you should talk to this person about this. But like, what I'm here is to support you. I'm like your paid accountability partner, and I'm going to connect you with resources that are going to help you. And so when I got connected to those resources, like, again, full force. I'm just a full force person. And I jumped in and I started eating better, and I started to be active at the time the program I was doing was 4 days a week, and I felt fabulous and I felt more energy, and I didn't feel like I wanted to hide under my blanket 24/7. And I started rolling with that. And so then I started helping other people, and I run an online group I co-run it with another coach, and we just share our story and we share what we're struggling with and we share what we're successful at, and we link people with resources and we help them reach what their goals are. And I mean, I always bring in the more like the mindfulness part of it and the mental wellness and like the other spokes of the wellness wheel, because it's not just one thing. And the more I've done that, the more I'm like continuing to be a learner and to learn more things, which actually have helped my clinic clients too, because part of coaching, there's three things. They're like, eat well, be active, and do personal development. So I have listened to podcasts on podcasts and read books and like on habits and mindfulness and like just all these different topics. And so then I'm able to like apply that to my coaching clients and apply that to my like clinic clients and apply it to my own life, and just great transition. And the more I learn from that aspect, and then more I learn about the nutrition aspect, and like I said, these scientists that are engineering these foods and the American diet, and how so many of these things, so many things that we experience can be managed by by being active and our nutrition. Mm-hmm. And it's crazy how people could like the stories that I have been privy to being starting to hear about how people were on like these ridiculous amount of medications. And then they started this journey towards wellness and they started to look at it more of preventative instead of, what's the other word for like afterwards?
Is it prescriptive, the other one?
I don't know. But the aftermath, the crisis management piece of it. Instead of like, oh, okay, you got this, so now we're just going to give you all these medications to just try to manage it. Why not we look at what we could do to prevent it and start to treat it with whole foods and nutrients and things that are going to help support our bodies and the fuel and being active and being connected with other people that are like-minded and community and like all these other bigger things. And I was listening, I think it was like 2 weeks ago, I was listening to a podcast about how like our world is in an epidemic, in a health epidemic. And we're seeing more and more people come up with autoimmune diseases and autism and more mental health issues, which, I mean, there's so many layers. It's not just one thing, but our overall like wellness is important and how we treat ourselves.
I can't get over the phrase that you used, the spokes of the wellness wheel. That is like, there is so much, you know, us as being in that health epidemic of like physical health, mental health, like overall wellness, like it's all on one thing, you know, like you can't just treat mental health if you have all of these physical things happening, or if you have, you know, it all just like ties in. It's so integrated. Like thinking of like a bike wheel, like that is such a great way. Like things are just, they cross over, they all connect in the middle. And that, you know, using that wholeness, that holistic approach in, and how I love hearing so much how it like this feeds into your clinic work too. And it feeds into you as a therapist of like, this is your wellness and your self-care. And then how much it changes your effectiveness as a therapist, you know, and then bringing all these cool things that you're learning outside in too, that it's all, you know, we are also a wheel like that, you know, that it's like, you have to have all those pieces to keep everything turning.
Yep.
Yeah, I love that so much. What if you had like a book or a podcast or, you know, what would you, I don't even know how to describe that, like tapping fingers together. It's like, it reminds me of Mr. Burns.
Oh my gosh, there's so many. Okay.
If you can think of any off the top of your head, I will put them in the show notes too. So
I'm looking up because I have a couple on my shelf.
Awesome.
So, okay. The Slight Edge by Jeff Olson was one of my favorites. It's one of the first ones. And it's like, it talks about the compounding habits and how like, okay, yeah, after one day, you're not going to see a change, but after 100 days, what's it going to look like? And so that's like a mindset book too. I love that one. I love Atomic Habits. He's awesome. I have to print out more of his worksheets because like not only does he have the book, but then he on his website, he gives you links to like worksheets that are very, very clinically based too. Like none of this is new stuff. And that's what I was telling someone else. I was like, the books that I'm reading, none of it's novel. I could connect it all back to different theories that I've learned and different types of like therapy. Like I can connect it all back, but we forget sometimes. And sometimes like it's always explained in a clinical way. And then now I'm reading in all these books and like connecting it with people's experiences. And then I'm like, oh, okay, that makes like a lot of sense. And I'm able to better explain it to my clients in a more like realistic way rather than like, this is scientifically how it works. Like,
yes, absolutely.
The Slight Edge by Jeff Olson, Atomic Habits. I mean, those are like more habit-based mindset. And then I really like listening to, I really like Lauren Fitzgerald, and it's Fitz and Health. Hold on. Fitz and Healthy is what it is. FITZ and Healthy. She happens to be another coach, but she is a medical doctor. And so she dives into a lot of why. Nutrition and being active and like that whole stuff, and very informative and very like, okay, like you know how to connect this like medical jargon to why this is important and
yeah,
why this works. So I like her. I've been listening to her a lot. Who have I actually listened to? Of course, Miss Rachel Hollis. I mean, who doesn't love her? So I flip between her, Rachel Hollis, and Empower Her, EMPOWER Her. And that's by Keisha Fitzgerald. And I don't even know if they're related. She also happens to be a coach, but she talks a lot about mindset. And she's like, she just turned 30, I think. So she's like really relatable. And she goes, I was in the corporate world and then I left it. I just got engaged and like super high energy and like just really fun to listen to. And she talks to you like you're talking over coffee and just like, we're friends on this podcast. Like if you messaged me, I might not talk to you like this, but like, I'm here to just be real with you and I'm going to throw it at you. And so I like bouncing between them because one's more like informative. And then Rachel Hollis is just like, she covers so many topics, but I'm not like, she's a mom of four or five. So like, I don't connect with that piece of it yet. But then there's Keisha who I do connect with because she just got engaged and she's going to get married. And like, that's similar to my lifestyle. So like being able to like connect with different pieces of each person is important. And that's why I bounce around.
Yeah, sure. I do the same thing with podcasts where I have to like bounce around depending on the way stuff is presented of like, oh, I really like this is very anecdotal based in its stories or case studies or whatever. And then this is like very straight science because it does like when I feel like when you digest that, it helps you like you were saying with the books, it helps you kind of have different ways to present it to clients or, you know, even for yourself, like whatever ways stick better. Then you're like, oh yeah, I've digested the scientific and then the case examples and then kind of this middle place, the research. And now you can like present it different ways to different clients depending on what they need.
Yeah.
I love that. Those are so many awesome, fantastic resources. Well, also, we are getting to that time. Where can our clients find you?
They can find me.
Our listeners.
Our people. You can find me on Instagram. It is purple.wellness.warrior. Awesome. On Facebook, it is just Danielle Nicole. Because of like client reasons, like it's kind of public, but I don't want it to be like too easy.
Yes. Yep.
Too easy for my clients to find me, but I'm there. I do have public stuff, but the things that I put out that are public, I just feel that it's stuff that I would say to a client anyway. Mm-hmm. And I don't hold anything back because I did struggle with that for a little bit. I was like, do I want to do like, especially like, oh, I'm going to be an online coach and have this public profile, but I'm also part of this part of my life that's supposed to be separate. And I was like, but I believe in what I'm saying. And I would say these things face to face with some of my clients anyway.
Yes.
So as long as I'm holding true to that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And we're allowed to have private lives outside of work. Yeah. It's just that with social media makes it really hard. Social media is a beast. Yes, for sure. Cool. So Instagram is the best place to find you.
Instagram would probably be the best. It's awesome. Completely public profile.
Very cool. Yes, this is fantastic. We've got a lot of resources. I'm excited. It's going to be a lot of stuff people can look up, finding you too. I follow Danielle on Instagram and I love it because it's very motivating. And I'm like, ooh, yeah. Like, oh, that's So I love it. It's super. It's like just a nice breath of fresh air in my Instagram feed. Well, Danielle, this has been so fantastic having you on. This has been such a awesome conversation of like wellness, of, you know, rural mental health. And we touched on so many cool things.
I know. And it was so exciting. I love talking about it.
I don't know about you guys, but I am feeling very inspired to go engage in some wellness activities and to do some self-care. This episode was so much fun. There's so many resources that are mentioned. All of those should be in the show notes as well. So go check that stuff out. It looks like a lot of really awesome stuff. Something I wanted to share as well is a story from one of our listeners of how they incorporated the songwriting protocol that was featured in episode 2. This comes from Lexi, And Lexi writes, "Hey, I listened to your podcast episode with Wade and tried that songwriting intervention idea that day. My six-year-old client chose 22 by Taylor Swift and picked out 5 words he liked and then wrote lyrics around that. At first he wanted me to sing with him, but then you can hear his confidence build and he asks to sing the last part alone. My favorite part is what he says at the end. He says, quote, we have to have my parents listen to this, end quote. Thought I'd share." Lexi, I love this story so much. Lexi actually shared an MP3 snippet of it as well, so I got to really hear a bunch of it. And it's so cool. I hope you get inspired by hearing that as well. Feel free to write in, let us know your stories. Other people want to hear them. How are you using this stuff? It's invigorating and inspiring to hear. So don't forget to follow us on Instagram. Feel free to write in with questions, your stories, concerns, would you rathers, whatever you'd like. You can find us on Instagram. You can write in through the website as well, creativetherapyumbrella.com. And always feel free to reach out via email. I love hearing from you. So take care and be creative.